taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were everyday Americans.
The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States prohibits Congress from writing laws that do five things. That would infringe on your right to freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, to peaceably assemble, or to petition your government for a redress of grievance. Now, most Americans are pretty familiar with the first three. Some of them talk about the fourth one, the right to peaceably assemble. They tend to forget the peaceable part, though. But I hear very few people talking about the right to petition your government for a redress of grievance. Yet we have seen, both through the acts of courts and Congress, the United States denying you, abridging your right to petition the government for a redress of grievance. So I thought today would be a good opportunity to talk about this right to petition for a redress of grievance and the infringements that are going on today and how it's impacting our lives. And then look at some of the examples of petition as we go out into the news. So hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to the Constitution Study. My name is Paul Engel. I am so glad you could join me today as we talk about this important right, this important concept, your ability to petition government for a redress of your grievances. The right to petition at its core is pretty simple. Webster's 1828 dictionary defines petition as a transitive verb, to make a request to, to ask from, to solicit, particularly to make supplication to a superior for some favor or right. You have a right to request your governments for a redress of a grievance, to correct some wrong. This can be in the form of petitioning your representatives or seeking redress in a court of law. To understand both the breadth and importance of the right to petition, we must first delve into the concept of sovereign immunity. West's Encyclopedia of American Law defines sovereign immunity as a judicial doctrine that prevents the government or its political subdivisions, departments, and agencies from being sued without its consent. The doctrine stems from the ancient English principle that the monarch can do no wrong. The doctrine of sovereign immunity places those in government above the law by protecting them from lawsuits simply because they are or work for some government agency. The concept of, or at least the abuse of, sovereign immunity was one of the grievances given when the colonies declared independence, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. Now granted, it was grievance number 15 out of 27, but it's there. The First Amendment included protecting this right to petition, but why? Because the principle of sovereign immunity is based on the principle that the sovereign cannot be wrong. In the United States of America, though, no one is supposed to be above the law. Now, the 11th Amendment is often used as an example of the states having sovereign immunity. However, this amendment did not prevent citizens from one state suing another state, only from doing so in federal court, as we read. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. Nowhere in the Constitution have I found a clause that would protect governments or government actors from being sued or prosecuted for any crimes they may commit. Even Article 1, Section 6 does not grant sovereign immunity to members of Congress. The senators and representatives shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place. Members of Congress may still be arrested while in session for certain serious crimes, such as treason or felonies. And there's not a protection from arrest when they are not attending or going to or from their respective houses. This protection from arrest while working for the government is not granted to any employee of Congress or any of the other branches of government. Courts, on the other hand, have been more than happy to grant this illegal protection to government employees to the detriment of the people and the very concept of justice. Which leads us to the Supreme Court case, Bivens versus six unknown federal narcotics agents. When studying the current jurisprudence regarding sovereign immunity in federal courts, the most common case cited is simply referred to as Bivens. In this case, Webster Bivens made the following complaint. Petitioner's complaint alleged that respondent agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, acting under color of federal authority, made a warrantless entry on his apartment, searched the apartment, and arrested him on narcotics charges. All of the acts were alleged to have been without the probable cause. Petitioner's suit to recover damages from the agents was dismissed by the district court on the alternative grounds, one, that it failed to state a federal cause of action, and two, that respondents were immune from suit by virtue of their official position. The Court of Appeals affirmed on the first ground alone. See, the district court dismissed the case for two reasons. First, that it failed to show a federal cause for action, a right to seek judicial redress. And second, as federal agents, the respondents were entitled to sovereign immunity. The Court of Appeals agreed with the district court on the question of cause of action, but ignored the question of sovereign immunity. Now, since the Court of Appeals ignored the sovereign immunity question, so did the Supreme Court of the United States. Having concluded that petitioner's complaint states a cause of action under the Fourth Amendment, we hold the petitioner is entitled to recover money damages for any injuries he has suffered as a result of the agent's violation of the amendment. In addition to holding that petitioner's complaint had failed to state facts making out a cause of action, the district court ruled that, in any event, respondents were immune from liability by virtue of their official position. This question was not passed on by the Court of Appeals, and accordingly, we do not consider it here. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. So while both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court did not deal with the question of immunity, it was ultimately decided that, since Mr. Bivens did have a cause of action, he could sue for damages. Since the question of immunity was ignored by these courts, it has not only survived but been modified by two rather interesting court cases. The first of these cases is Butts versus Economou. In his case, Economou sued federal officials after claiming that the Department of Agriculture instituted illegal proceedings against him, violating several of his constitutionally protected rights. Both the district court and the Supreme Court agreed that while federal officers are not entitled to absolute immunity, they are entitled to qualified immunity. Now, the Free Legal Dictionary defines qualified immunity as, in the United States, qualified immunity is a legal principle that grants government officials performing discretionary functions immunity from civil suits unless the plaintiff shows that the official violated clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. Now, in Nixon versus Fitzgerald, Mr. Fitzgerald lost his job as a management analyst with the Department of the Air Force after testifying before a congressional subcommittee. Mr. Fitzgerald filed a complaint with the Civil Service Commission, which was rejected. Mr. Fitzgerald then filed a suit in federal court against several Department of Defense officials, then amended the complaint to include Richard M. Nixon, who was President of the United States at the time of his termination. Now, the Supreme Court found, petitioner, as a former President of the United States, is entitled to absolute immunity from damages liability predicated on his official acts. The court went on to explain that while there is no blanket recognition of absolute immunity for federal officials, certain officials, such as judges and prosecutors, required an absolute exemption from liability, meaning that while these officials did not have absolute immunity for their actions, they did have immunity from federal lawsuits. Furthermore, the court noted that due to separation of powers, the president had absolute immunity due to his office. The court also noted that absolute immunity was limited to his actions within the duties of his office and that there were other mechanisms such as impeachment to redress presidential misconduct. Now, one thing to remember is that these cases deal with immunity from civil suit, not criminal prosecution, and only for actions taken within the boundaries of their official duties. But what happens when Congress flagrantly violates your right to petition government for a redress of grievance? Enter the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness, or the PREP Act.
Of the many illegal acts committed by governments at all levels in response to COVID-19, one of the most egregious was Congress's attempt to abridge your right to petition your government for a redress of grievance, at least when it came to the question of vaccinations. From Title 42, Section 247-6D, which is called the Targeted Liability Protection for Pandemic and Epidemic Products and Security Countermeasures, we read, "Subject to the other provisions of this section, a covered person shall be immune from suit and liability under federal and state law with respect to all claims for loss caused by, arising out of, relating to, or resulting from the administration to, or the use by an individual of a covered countermeasure if a declaration under subsection B has been issued with respect to such countermeasure." In English, those who manufacture and administer certain covered countermeasures were immune from lawsuits. If you are injured by one of these products, say an mRNA vaccine designed to prevent the spread of COVID-19, you could not sue the manufacturer, the employer who coerced you into taking the shot, or the person who failed to inform you of the possible side effect. Even though it's against both federal law and medical ethics to use coercion, failure to inform the recipient of possible side effects, and of the fact that they can decline treatment in an attempt to get someone to take a product released under an emergency use authorization, Congress claims to have given those involved blanket immunity for their criminal acts. Or have they? You see, the First Amendment to the Constitution states, "Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievance." Congress is forbidden from making a law that abridges your right to petition the government for a redress of grievance. That means that Section 247-6D of the PREP Act is repugnant to the Constitution. And according to the Supreme Court of the United States, that means this law is void. From the opinion on the Marbury versus Madison case, "Certainly, all those who have framed written constitutions contemplate them as forming the fundamental and paramount law of the nation, and consequently, the theory of every such government must be that an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void." So what does this mean to all those who have been injured, either by these vaccines or by the coercion to participate in a medical experiment, and believe they have no redress? For one thing, it shows the importance of John Jay's admonition. "Every member of the state ought diligently to read and to study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing their rights, they will sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them." See, by knowing your rights, you can see this act of Congress is legally meaningless. It's another tool we can bring to bear if and when we exercise our right and seek the redress that Congress wishes to deny us. It's the preparation to both defend our rights and assert them when those in government wish to deny them to us. Whether that person be in Congress, the president, a judge, or an agent of government, we need not only know what our rights are, but how we can defend them. If we wish to be citizens in a free republic, then we must stand when those who have been charged with defending our rights instead trample them. Unless you wish to live as a subject of a tyrannical government, one which acts as if those who work for it cannot be wrong, then we must join together and assist those who have been both injured by these drugs and denied their right to petition for a redress of grievance. Congress, the president, and indeed governments and employers at all levels have broken the law. Who will be the first to pick up the sacred fire of liberty and make a stand? And how many of us will stand with them?
So I hope you see why I say the details are important. Yes, Congress passed the PREP Act. Yes, it was signed. But no, the immunity given to the makers of these drugs is not constitutional. It is void. It should be empty and meaningless. And that needs to be defended. That needs to be defended in court. It needs to be defended in states. It needs to be defended everywhere. Now, there's some other cases where the details matter. For example, many of you may have heard that a U.S. appeals court overturned a lower court's injunction blocking the COVID-19, quote-unquote, vaccine mandate for federal employees. Well, the details are very interesting because it doesn't appear the court made brought any opinion about the actual validity or constitutionality of the mandate. They claimed that the people bringing the suit didn't follow the right process. See, the issue is, under the 1978 Civil Service Reform Act, if a federal worker believes they are facing an adverse action, they have to appeal to what's called the Merit System Protection Board, which decides whether or not the worker was properly disciplined, and if improperly disciplined, can go and seek redress. It's very similar. You know, I've seen headlines about the Supreme Court siding with the Biden administration about an Air Force officer protesting the mandates. Well, all the Supreme Court did was decline to hear the case. The case isn't done yet. In both of these, the petition is still moving forward. It's just moving forward in different venues. In the case of federal employees, I guess it's going to end up at the Merit Systems Protection Board. And in the case of the Air Force officer, it is going back to a lower court. So it's not done yet. But it's, again, it's stuff we need to pay attention to. It's the type of thing where seeking redress is so important. I'm about to head off to a break, but before I do, have you considered your immune system lately? You know, that amazing part of your body that fights off all the diseases, everything from germs and viruses to bacteria, cuts. Sometimes it needs a little help. Now, HealthyCell.com has a wonderful product called Immune Super Boost. It is designed to support your immune system with a simple travel-ready gel pack. Combines over a dozen immune supplements in one dose. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. So go to HealthyCell.com, use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. It'll tell them that you're listening to America Out Loud, and they will give you 20% off at checkout. So once again, that's HealthyCell.com, and be sure to use the code OUTLOUD.
This is Dr. Peter McCullough. Do you know there's no other condition that I'm aware of where vitamins and supplements make such a big difference than COVID-19. We have an abundance of data that we need to be replete with a variety of micronutrients, and that includes vitamins, minerals, and other substances our bodies need. I rely on Healthy Cell Super Boost. That's Immune Super Boost. It's a gel pack that can be taken every day. I like to do it before I exercise and before I go out. It's a wonderful supplement. It gives me the immune super boost that I need. Go to HealthyCell.com, use the promotional code OUTLOUD, and get a discount on your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health 4 times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, HealthyCell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, and today we're talking about redress of grievance, your right to petition for a redress of grievance. And there's a lot of places we can look and see this. Well, for example, a court has found that California's diversity law, well, that it's unconstitutional. Or at least according to the reporting. I haven't found the opinion to read it yet. But what's interesting, because the California law required that certain businesses have a minimum of one member of the board of directors from an underrepresented community, which the law defines as an individual who self-identifies as Black, African-American, Hispanic, Latino, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, Native Hawaiian, or Alaska Native, or who self-identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or gender. Now, what's interesting is according to the complaint, which was filed by, I believe it's Judicial Watch, they say, because it classifies directors by virtue of their race, ethnicity, sexual preference, or transgender status, AB 979 can only be justified by compelling government interest, and its use of race and ethnicity must narrowly tailored to serve that compelling interest. As defendant cannot make these difficult showings, AB 979 is unconstitutional, and any expenditure of taxpayer funds or taxpayer finance resources in furtherance of ensuring compliance quotas required by AB 979 is illegal. Now, this is an area where I disagree. This is the one area where I disagree. Yes, it is unconstitutional, not because it does not, because California has not shown a compelling government interest, because it blatantly violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which says, among other things, that no state shall pass a law depriving someone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. California is claiming the authority to control the property the shareholders have in certain businesses to make up their own board of directors to lead that company. So, it's one of those, the details matter. A little bit of good news, but probably not as good as many of you thought. And another one of those good news, bad news. Did you hear that a judge ordered the removal of 5 Pennsylvania school board members over mandatory mask mandates? And many people cheered. And I looked a little closer at what was happening, and basically, there was a lawsuit. There was a complaint filed back in February in the County Court of Common Pleas. And in the filing, they say that children are permanently and irreparably harmed due to the mass, and that the actions of these board members created and implemented illegal policies that violate constitutional rights and, as such, cause irreparable harm. Okay, but here's the interesting point. It's one thing for a judge to say, listen, in my opinion, that mask mandate is unconstitutional. Where does a Pennsylvania judge get the authority to remove members of an elected school board? Isn't that the responsibility of the voters? Again, I'm not an expert on Pennsylvania Constitution, but did they actually give the judicial branch of the government of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania the authority to remove members elected by the people? It is the people's responsibility to remove the board members. It is not the courts. So again, good news, bad news. On the one hand, these mandatory mask mandates in Pennsylvania schools aren't going in this one school district. This was at Westchester, I believe it was. But on the other hand, you once again see a judge overstepping the mark, going beyond their delegated powers to say, no, we're actually going to order the removal of these board members. Now, the judge could even probably go so far as to request an investigation of these board members for any criminal activity that would have, you know, if these mask mandates are illegal, if they violated Pennsylvania law, if it was actually criminal law. But he went too far. The judge went too far by ordering the removal of these board members. Now, I understand the feeling of the parents in this district, right? We want them gone. But if you're going to let a Pennsylvania judge order the removal of board members you don't like, couldn't that same judge order removal of members that you do like? See, that's the danger of giving arbitrary powers to members of government. They went beyond the petition for a redress of grievance to petition, say, this mask mandate violates the Constitution, it violates the law, is a proper petition for a redress of grievance. Now, I'm not sure if the complaint requested the removal, but the fact that it was that a judge ordered the removal of an elected official, I'm pretty sure violates the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Because generally, removal from an elected office requires impeachment, which is usually the impeachment is made by the representatives of the people, by the House, and it's tried in the Senate, or whatever the state version of those two bodies are. Petition isn't a blanket, I get what I want. We still have to follow the law, including the laws, the supreme laws, like the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and of the United States of America. See, I was having an interesting discussion with someone the other day, and we're talking about this idea of ends justifying means. And the slippery slope that becomes, that comes of that. You see, ends justifying means are usually used to deprive you of your rights. If it's a protection of your rights, it's generally you don't have to violate the law to enforce the law, generally. Right? If you're protecting someone's rights, that's usually approved by the law. But if you're willing to violate the law to get an end that you want, not only can that be used against you, but it's a slippery slope. We're all familiar with the story. We've seen it in movies and television programs of someone that succumbs to some small temptation, or they compromise morals, or they compromise the law in a small way because the ends justify the means. Only it never stops there. It snowballs. Whether it's a person, a gambler going to a loan shark, or a store owner dealing with the mob, or even a situation of someone stealing to feed their family. They rarely stop there. They continue to grow. You go from stealing bread to stealing frozen foods to stealing maybe stuff you don't need to feed your family. You go from gambling a little bit to gambling a lot, to the point where you borrow a little bit, then you borrow a lot. Now you're tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, sometimes to people who are really known for their draconian collection tactics. Or the situation where, yes, I'll compromise and I'll deal with a criminal, not realizing that they will then hold that over you and they will ask more and more and more. I understand the logic of these groups. I understand the desire. I understand that California's diversity law, corporate diversity law, is unconstitutional. That's not the question. I understand, okay, life is good. I wish the judge had found it unconstitutional because it was a violation, because depriving someone of control of the property they have in their business, whether that be a sole ownership, a sole proprietorship, or owning stock, is the reason why it's wrong, not because California couldn't come up with a good enough reason to infringe on your rights. And I understand the desire of the Pennsylvania families to get rid of evil and corrupt board members, or at least corrupt. Whether or not they're truly evil is a discussion for another day. But if you're willing to compromise the protections of your rights, of the rights of these board members, to get your way, what's to stop someone from compromising your rights, from violating your rights to get their way? It becomes the Lord of the Flies. Whoever's the biggest and strongest gets their way. For example, in the U.S. District Court of Western District of Virginia, a judge has issued a temporary injunction based on a lawsuit about 12 parents of children that are high risk of COVID. You have a judge saying, we will violate the rights of the vast majority of the parents and children in the school district because these parents want everybody to mask because their children are at higher risk. Now listen, I feel sorry for any child that have diseases that would put them at higher risk. But here again, you have, well, we'll compromise. We will infringe on the rights of the majority because a small few, a very small minority, want you to. See, there's nothing, as I understand it, in the law in Virginia that was challenged by this lawsuit that says children are not allowed to wear masks. There is nothing stopping the children of these parents from wearing masks. What they're not allowed to do is force others to wear masks. You see the point? The very same technique of, well, the ends justify the means. You have a judge, a district judge in Virginia, that says the right of the parents to enforce their will on the other children, not their children, the other children, trumps a parent's right of controlling the health care of their own child. Now, both these cases, we have parents seeking a redress of a grievance. On one, both, by the way, involving mask mandates. One that wants the mask mandates lifted, one that wants them imposed. And what we have are two different judges with two different styles, possibly two different agendas, coming up with two diametrically opposite decisions. In both cases, I believe the judges are wrong. The judge in Pennsylvania was wrong, not because he found the mask mandate unconstitutional, but because he ordered the removal of elected officials. The Virginia judge is wrong is because he's willing to compromise the rights, not just the rights of the majority of the students in favor of a few. Now, it'd be one thing if wearing masks were innocuous, right? If having all the kids wear masks, it'd be like saying, okay, all the kids have to wear blue shirts. That would be innocuous. That doesn't really change anything. And the injunction would allow the lawsuit to proceed and no one would be harmed. But there's more and more evidence, mounting evidence from the CDC and from others that masking children, especially small children, is damaging to their education. It's damaging to their physical health. It's damaging to their mental health. It is delaying the educational process. It's delaying the use of language. It is interfering with the educational process. Now, I don't know how many children are impacted by this judge's injunction. What I do know is that it is a lot more than the children represented by the 12 parents. But even if it was just one child, is it a right or not? Can you be deprived of liberty, of the control of the property you have in your body without due process of law or not? See, seeking redress doesn't mean getting redress. Seeking redress means you're looking for a fix to the problem. But we're still dependent on others to come to the right conclusion if we're going to get the redress we desire. And just because we desire it doesn't make it right, doesn't make it legal, doesn't make it constitutional. So here we have two states right next to each other. Again, mask mandates in schools. And we see, once again, the redress that we seek having problems. Where our dependence on the courts as the ultimate arbiter of truth bites us right in the backside. Right? If I were one of those school board members in Pennsylvania, I'd refuse to leave. I'd say, wait a second, the judge doesn't have the legal authority. I'd find in the Constitution of Pennsylvania, the judge doesn't have the legal authority to remove a school board, unless it's in there. Maybe it is, and I'm not an expert on Pennsylvania Constitution. And if I were the parents of the students in Virginia, not only would I send my children to school without a mask, I would inform the school district and all of its members that if they attempt to touch their child make them wear a mask, they will file charges of assault. Because just because a judge issues an injunction, a federal judge issues, doesn't mean the state is compelled to enforce it. Judges issued orders that required the internment of Japanese during the Second World War, the returning of escaped slaves under the Dred Scott opinion. The states need to stand up and say, wait a second, this judge's injunction is in itself a violation of the rights of the parents. Now, whether the remaining parents of the school district simply go to the appeal to the circuit court or the Supreme Court or simply to their state to protect them from an overzealous federal judge, they still need to petition for a redress of their grievance, of the abuse being done to their children. Now, I have to take another break. Before I do, I want to remind you that not only can you listen to the Constitution study on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, you can also find us on podcast. All these episodes go to podcast generally 2 to 3 days after they're heard on the radio. You can find them on Spotify, Stitcher, iHeart Podcast, basically anywhere you listen to your podcasts. Find these episodes and don't just listen to them, share them. Help other people find and listen to the Constitution Study, to America Out Loud Talk Radio, to find the information that they will find valuable as they attempt to live free in this country that seems bent on taking away our freedom. Now, the other thing is, I'd love to meet you face-to-face. I'm putting together a tour where I'm going to go around the country in 2022. I'm working on a new talk to give, and I want to meet people face-to-face. I want to shake their hands. I want to say hello. If you would like me to come speak at your event, speak to your group, or just see if I can stop by as I'm driving around, well, contact me through the Constitution Study at constitutionstudy.com/tour. There's a form at the bottom of the page you can fill out and see if I can come visit you while I tour this great country.
In today's world, there's no escaping the headlines filled with warnings about emerging viruses and dangerous superbugs. Genesis is the only technology that safely and effectively obliterates harmful pathogens both in the air and on surfaces. Genesis plus HOCL neutralize these threats to your environment in just seconds. Find out more about this amazing technology at genesisfogger.com/outloud for a 15% discount. With Genesis, you'll be prepared for what's next.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
You've been in that situation. The person next to you is sniffling, or worse yet, coughing. Flu, cold, and coronaviruses are everywhere. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to reduce these threats with an invisible mask as an additional layer of protection? Sold by hundreds of pharmacists and medical doctors, our American-made povidone iodine antiviral nasal spray, Cofix RX, lasts for hours deactivating viruses and germs while protecting you from airborne pathogens that make us sick. America Out Loud listeners get 20% off. Use Cofix RX while in large groups, while traveling, or for any other type of high-risk situation as an additional layer of protection to help reduce your likelihood of catching a cold, the flu, or SARS-CoV-2 viruses. Right now, America Out Loud listeners get 20% off of all orders. Click our banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about a redress of grievance. And we've talked a bit about the process and the importance. But did you realize that you have an important role in that redress process? See, according to both the Sixth and Seventh Amendments, you have a right to a jury trial. Well, in a civil case, the issue in question has to be at least $20. But you have a right to a trial by jury. Meaning, you have your fellow citizens will be making the decision about the outcome of your petition for redress. And hopefully, when you get that little thing in the mail, you know, the jury summons that most people go, most people try to find a way to get out of. We've heard the saying, right? You're not tried by a jury of your peers, but by a jury of 12 people who couldn't figure out how to get out of jury duty. Jury duty is important. Jury duty is part of that redress process. It takes the ultimate decision out of the hands of the state in the form of the judge and puts it in the hands of everyday people, the people on the jury. This can have a very important outcome. For example, you probably heard about the kidnapping plot attempting to kidnap Governor Whitmer. Well, now that it's gone to trial and went to a jury, you have the everyday ordinary people looking at what was going on and saying, we don't think so. See, the jury refused to convict four men that were standing trial for supposedly plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Whitmer. Now, there was a lot of evidence that the FBI tricked them into this plan, that they were entrapped. Meaning, if left up to government, well, they could have just listened to the FBI and gone ahead, but it wasn't left up to government. It was left up to everyday, ordinary people who had the future of these four men in their hands. And they looked at the case, and they saw the evidence and said, maybe this is not as cut and dried as we were first led to believe. These four men are free. Because jurors got to look at the evidence and say, no, this is wrong. The petition to redress, to arrest these men for attempting to kidnap the governor is wrong. There is no grievance there because it wasn't these men that were doing it. It was the FBI that was enticing them, that was encouraging them, that was tricking them into doing this. As I said, not all petitions are valid. Just because you ask for a redress grievance doesn't mean there was an actual grievance. But it's the importance of the jury and the jury trial to look at this and say, okay, maybe it's about time we take those jury summons a bit more seriously. That we stop working so hard to get out of jury duty and start taking our responsibility as a member of a jury, a bit more somberly, a bit more seriously. Now, that was over in Michigan. Louisiana right now is asking the Supreme Court to block a Biden administration policy to look at the quote-unquote social cost of carbon emissions. You see, as the federal government is, well, doing their diabolical best to run every part of our life, They're trying to control carbon emissions. And they're looking and say, well, what is the cost of the carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere by different processes, by different industries? They wanted to add this idea of a social cost. Now, how you calculate a social cost of a release of a gas that every one of us breathes out every moment, every minute of every day, I don't know. But my issue isn't with the question of the carbon tax. You have the people of Louisiana, the state of Louisiana, in this case, in the auspice of Attorney General Jeff Landry, who is petitioning the Supreme Court of the United States to prevent the Biden administration from implementing this rule. Now, I haven't gone into the details of their petition. I haven't looked at it yet. But I bring this to you because, again, it's an example of a state saying, excuse me, Supreme Court, we have a grievance with the presidential administration. We want your opinion. We want a redress from this. We think that they've gone too far. Now, yes, this is the Attorney General of the state of Louisiana. This is the government of Louisiana. But remember, they're doing this in the name of the citizens of Louisiana, of the people they believe this is wrong. They have a grievance. They're seeking a petition. The question I have here is the Supreme Court of the United States the final arbiter of whether or not the president has the authority to do this, of whether or not this is constitutional? See, when we're looking for a redress, it's important we go to somebody that can actually help. Now, getting the opinion of the court as to whether or not this is constitutional or not has its advantages, right? If the Supreme Court says, yes, this has gone too far, we don't think the president has the authority to do this, they cannot stop the president from doing this. They can order, they can stomp and complain, but they can't actually stop the president because the president's a separate branch of government. The president of the United States is not under the Supreme Court, neither is the Supreme Court under the president of the United States. So then what? See, really, and they may be doing this in the background, I would love to see Louisiana working with other states going, wait a second, did we actually delegate to the United States the authority to regulate carbon emissions? Did we? Or did they just make this up? Did Congress pass a law that was not pursuant to the Constitution of the United States, and we've just been buffaloed into following it for all these years? Because remember, the court saying something is so doesn't mean people will follow it. People will act that way. That's why, you know, when I see a state, especially nowadays, begging the federal government for protection from the federal government, I know we're in trouble. Now, of course, there's more issues. Many of you may be familiar with Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. She seems to be hated from people left, right, and center. And I've said this before, words are important. Well, right now, recently, a federal judge has approved an effort by a group of Georgia voters to disqualify Ms. Greene from running for re-election. Now, this judge, Amy Tottenberg, denied Greene's request for a preliminary injunction and a temporary restraining orders against the voters that are trying to prevent her from being on the ballot. Now, it's not that Ms. Greene is going to be denied from the ballot. She asked for it to stop, preliminary injunction. She asked for a temporary restraining order for preventing the voters from refiling because they're trying to get her disqualified on the grounds of she participated in an insurrection. See, under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, no person can be a senator, representative, elected officer if, while holding state or federal office, they participated in an insurrection or rebellion. See, this is why I say words matter. Just because someone declares January 6th an insurrection doesn't mean it's an insurrection. What happened on January 6th is not a legal insurrection. What she has done is not a rebellion. It's not insurrection. I've yet to see any evidence of this. Now, a lot of people are attacking the judge, saying that the judge is restricting free speech and a lot of other things, maybe possibly ignoring the Constitution's point that what a member of the House or Senate says on the floor is not to be questioned anywhere. But we have, once again, a petition. In this case, it was a petition by Representative Greene saying that this is, in effect, malicious a case and asking the court to stop it before it went any farther, caused her any more harm or damage, and the court has decided not to. This is an interesting case because, as I've talked about before, I hear people referring to what's happening at the southern border as an invasion. I've heard a lot of people referring to January 6th as an insurrection. And I warned, I said, they're using the word insurrection because they want to invoke the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment and use it as a way to prevent their opposition from holding office. Now, according to the judge, Greene did not meet a burden of persuasion in her request for injunctive relief. I'm curious because I don't know that the voters that are suing to deny Ms. Greene the ability to run for re-election have met any burden of proof that she's actually committed insurrection. So that's still going forward. It still proves that this redress, this petition for redress, is still a messy business. There's a lot going on, and nope, it rarely is it the person get everything they want. Frequently, the redress you're petitioning for isn't a viable. It's not something that can be done. But it's the only way that people are allowed to protect their rights is if they can ask for a redress of grievance. And in the last story I want to cover today, we have another case that appears to be going to the Supreme Court. You see, there's a policy at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Virginia that removed the standardized test from the equation in determining who they would accept, and added things like, well, attendance at a middle school that they deemed historically underrepresented at the school. Well, there's a bunch of parents and even students and teachers that are suing against this policy. They say it is discriminatory, especially against Asian American students. You have a high school dedicated to teaching about, I'm assuming, science and technology. It's in their name. And what they're saying is, listen, the best science and technology students aren't necessarily going to be the ones we accept, because other middle schools that, for whatever reason, have been historically underrepresented, we're going to place students from that. We're going to place what middle school you went to as a more important than your actual skills as measured by standardized testing. Now, I haven't read the policy. I haven't gone that deep into it. But from what I've read, I would say that the admissions policy at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology is unfair. Now, parents note that after this policy, a lower percentage of Asian American students were admitted to Thomas Jefferson High School. Now, again, the policy itself doesn't use race. Is the policy itself racist? It doesn't appear to be. It's unfair, but it doesn't appear to be inherently racist, although it does have a racial impact, which gets back to the scenario. Just because an impact can be measured racially, does that mean the policy is racist? Well, that's going to be fought out at the Supreme Court. But it's an interesting grievance. A district court judge did say it is clear that Asian American students are disproportionately harmed. But is that because of their race or because the Thomas Jefferson High School has some agenda that they want these middle schools? In other words, are they trying to get students from these middle schools because of their race, or is it something else? Are they simply trying to get students from lower incomes? We don't know. It's one of the reasons why I get concerned when we say, well, it has a disproportional harm for a specific race, because it assumes an intent that may not be there. But again, what we see is parents petitioning the government for a redress of grievance. It's making its way apparently all the way up to the Supreme Court to see whether or not Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology has a legal authority to determine admission based on zip code rather than test scores. Because that's really what this is, right? It's we don't want test scores. We're going to use middle schools, which is generally based on the zip code you live in. So again, this is a case I'll probably be talking about more in the future. But it's understanding that right to go and say, we're going to sue because we don't like this policy. We're going to sue because we don't like this law. We're going to sue because we have what we believe to be a grievance, is a fundamental right. It is a critical to a functioning republic. Because if you don't have the chance to seek a fix for a problem, then how do you ever correct the problem? Now, yes, it's messy. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, people don't always get what they want. They don't always get the right answer, the constitutional answer, the lawful answer. But that is so far the best system we have, is to allow you the chance to seek a redress. But before I close out today, I want you to consider this. Is there a firewall? Is there a legitimate attempt to stop a petition for a redress of grievance when the actual petition for the redress is the grievance itself. The example I use is the Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, the federal law that says you cannot sue a gun manufacturer for the illegal or abusive use of a legitimate product. You can sue them for a defect in the product. You can sue them for something they did. You can't sue them for something that somebody else did with their product. That's often referred to as a violation, effectively as a violation of your right to petition. But what you're doing is you're punishing the wrong person, and they have a right to petition, say, wait a second, you can't sue us simply because somebody did something wrong with something we made. We don't do that in any other place. So again, as you can see, this right to petition, it's not a simple cut and dry scenario. But we need to make sure that we protect a people's right to petition for a redress of grievance and protect them from malicious prosecution at the same time. Like so many things in a free country, it's a balancing act. It's not a simple and clean process. But again, it's the best process we have to protect you, to protect, more importantly, your rights. Not just a petition, but that petition to protect all of your rights. Now, before I go, I want you to know, please make AmericaOutLoud.com your daily stop for the latest news and happenings. It's more important than ever that we all do our job, that we participate in this republic by sharing the stories, the articles, the podcasts, and the videos so we can help secure the blessings of liberty, not for just for ourselves, but for our posterity.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.